You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Hello. My guest today is Gilad Atzmon. He is an Israeli-born British jazz musician and also an author and an activist. He plays over 200 gigs a year on his saxophone, and he's been called the hardest gigging man in British jazz, and he still has time to write, and he still has time to rail against what he sees are many, many deep Jewish injustices, Zionist injustices across the world. Thanks for joining us, Gilad.
My pleasure.
I appreciate that. We've been speaking a little bit before this, and I found out a lot about what you'd like to do and what you're working on. I just want to say before we start that you served, of course, in the Israeli Defense Forces, as I think every Israeli citizen has to. And you served as a paramedic in during the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and you saw a lot of nasty stuff. You saw the war machine in action, and that really had a deep impact on you. Is that right?
Yeah, I've never been a hero soldier, and I hardly walk about my military past, but I saw enough to understand that something was completely wrong, and that the narrative that I was brought on is on the verge of phantasmic, and had nothing to do with reality.
Now, you have a master's degree in philosophy. You became a British citizen in 2002. You've written a book that was published in almost 30 languages called A Guide to the Perplexed, which I put on my wish list. I'm going to get that pretty soon. You call for not a two-state solution, but a one-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because you believe that that's the Palestinians' land and they should get it back. Your comments have actually been used recently by Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan when he cited you during a debate with Israeli President Shimon Peres. And I imagine that that was inspired by the Gaza offensive, because I know that the Turkish elites were particularly bothered by that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is definitely the case. And I think that, interestingly enough, Turkey is doing a very good job for Palestine. I just read a transcript of Turkish Prime Minister in Arab League today, and he was definitely furious, denouncing Israel and blaming Israel for launching a storm in the region.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good guy.
Erdogan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we were talking a little bit earlier, before we recorded, you said that you believe that the Zionists invented their national identity in the late 19th century. Can you expound a little bit on that?
Actually, I think that the best work on the subject was compiled by Israeli professor Shlomo Zand, who wrote a book named "The Invention of the Jewish People."
Right.
Basically, it's a long story, but to try to make it short, we have to understand that there is no such a thing as Jewish history. Jews never wrote history. Between 70, Josephus Flavius, and I think 1840, there was not a single Jewish text written. We are talking here about 1750 years, 1750 years of years with no Jewish history. There is a reason that we don't have Jewish history. Jews, or definitely the rabbinical Judaism, didn't need history at all, because the Torah, the Jewish Bible, stand as an insight into Jewish faith. It has all the answers that Jews, rabbinical needed within their concept of rabbinical Judaism. However, following emancipation of European Jewry and the rise of European nationalism, Jews, like many other people in Europe, looked for identity, and they then invented the Jewish identity. There were two Jewish national schools. One was the Zionism. They eventually believed that moving world Jewry into one place, namely Palestine, would solve all the Jewish problems. And they were, by the way, very, very anti-Semitic.
Right.
If you read early Zionists, what they had to say about the Jews, you know, you would probably be devastated. So on the one hand, you had Zionism, who invented the story of Jewish nation, Jewish people. They also invented a myth about their racial origin and their belonging to the region, to the Middle East, which is a complete fantasy, because as we know, most, if not all, of European Jews are of Khazarian origin. Khazaria was a kingdom in southern eastern Europe, near Armenia, Turkmenistan, and if the Jews really want to go to their promised land, they probably have to settle in Armenia.
Or Central Asia.
It's not Central Asia. So they made up a story. So we, on one end, we had the Zionist, and the other end, we had the Bundist, who were the Jewish socialists of East Europe, who decided their nation, and obviously their ideology was completely rejected by Vladimir Lenin, who told them that they cannot be a nation unless they cannot be a nation unless it's geographically orientated. So they invented the Jewish cosmopolitan nation, which Zand actually called the Yiddish nation. These two concepts of nationhood were completely fantasmic. The Bund disappeared around 1917. Some other people said that it disappeared after in the Second World War. And the Zionism didn't disappear. People were slightly more gifted within the Zionist movement, and it had become a very sinister movement. In 1948, they've managed to gain a state on Palestine. They managed to ethnically cleanse the vast majority of Palestinian people. And in the last 60 years, we are what we see is the action of global Zionism putting our planet on a constant threat.
Now, we talked also a little earlier about the United States has AIPAC. Where you live, you live in England. There's the board of deputies of British Jews. There are all these entities around the world fomenting incidents and keeping things unstable, creating wars here and there for probably financial reasons.
It's a big question. One of the biggest questions, there is no doubt they are all operating as a tribal entities. They try to influence our governments. They push for wars. You know, I remember seeing, I was shocked. I remember seeing AJC, American Jewish Committee,
right,
advert in the London Financial Times, promoting a conflict with Iran 5 or 6 years ago. which is mind blowing. They do it all in the open.
Right.
What? Why they do it? What are they after? This is a very, very big question. If they really want to look after the Jewish people, to defend the Jewish people, to protect the Jewish people, they don't do a good job. Because, as you know, that we are talking about it, many other people talk about it, their activity is exposed, and they endanger more Jews than any anti-Semite I can think of.
Right.
You know, so it's not they don't look really after Jewish interest.
Right.
And I cannot see how they make much money out of it. It's not clear at all what they do. This is one of the questions that I struggle to answer. I don't understand what they're after.
So you don't think they're making money off of these endless wars and the business cycle booming and busting?
It's a big question. There is no doubt that the people who are mobilizing this movement may make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can think about Madoff, Bernie Madoff. He was pretty much sorted for more than a while.
Just got beat up, I read.
It's not very surprising.
Right, one of his inmates.
You know, I would guess that Shimon Wiesenthal probably, Elie Wiesel
right,
probably beat him, you know, because
right.
All the money that he made with his kind of little Holocaust factory went astray with this Bernie Ponzi Madoff.
Right, of course.
But, you know, it's not that easy to make money, you know, at the end of the day, you know.
No.
But anyway, so there is no doubt that people within this closed circuit of AIPAC, or, you know, they may make... A lot of money, but it's definitely not something that serves the tribe as a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So still, it is very hard to understand what they do. I quite a few years ago, I came up, I think, with a slightly innovative concept. I came up with the question. With a very simple question, where is the kind of high command of the Jewish tribe? Where are decisions being made about the fate of the Jewish future or the Jewish fate?
Mm-hmm.
Is it in the Knesset? Is it in the Israeli government cabinet? Is it in the Mossad? Is it in Wall Street? Is it in Wall Street Journal or the New York Times? Is it in, in a kind of a Chabad, you know, a Brooklyn kind of rabbinical institute? And I think that what we see here is a network. Is a network. And within this network,
right,
everyone has a role, and you understand your role through your upbringing. So if you are a soldier in the Gaza border and you see a Hamas freedom fighter Obviously, they don't see them as freedom fighter because they're not clever enough. Right. But if you're a Hamas, a freedom fighter, coming towards you and trying to plant a kind of an explosive or whatever, you go after him and you risk your life like yesterday and you may die.
Right.
If you are in a pub in London, you're a Jew and you hear people discussing the Holocaust, you may call the police and you report them. Mm-hmm. If you are in the White House as a chief advisor or of chief of staff, mm-hmm. you do what you have to do. You don't have to get instruction from everyone. The whole idea of the Jewish upbringing, this non-history that matures into a phantasmic tale, is something that you practice for at least 2,000-3,000 years. It is indoctrinate you to do the right thing in the right place.
Now that's the what we talked about earlier prior to the recording. That's the story of Esther. Can you elaborate on that, please?
The story of what?
Esther. You said APAC's been around for thousands of years.
This is a very, you know, I spoke about Obama, you know, and I know that Obama faces a lot of criticism for failing to act and to do the right things. And, you know, obviously I don't want to, to contribute to this discussion. And what I say to people who come up with it is that the most simplistic way to look at it, you know, is that Obama, you know, doesn't have a chance to understand the Middle East conflict, for instance, or the Israeli-Palestine conflict, mm-hmm. within a year or 2 years and not even 8 years. It would take 20 years, sometimes 30 years for us to understand it. Sometimes a lot of friends that I come across, you know, manage to retire and, you know, to age this discourse without really understanding it. I see among my audience and readers, some of them are 60, 70, 80 years old.
They still don't get it. And they still
kind of read my writings. Oh, man, we never thought about it, you know.
Right.
So the chance of even a very, very clever man to understand all the anecdotes, to understand what Jewish identity is, what Zionism is, what the Palestinian cause is, is not very complicated. This is the simplest thing here. There's just people who are ethnically cleansed that want to go back to their land. This is very, very simple.
Right.
But the viciousness of the Zionist movement and how it is entangled with the Bible and the Messianic belief is something that is quite complicated to comprehend.
Right.
Now, the problem that we have with liberal democracies is that politicians are coming for 4 years, 8 years. Sometimes they manage to stay around for 12 years.
Long time.
This is long time. This is not enough to understand or to move things forward. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely the people who stay here forever are people like IPAC who are doing the same job for the last 3,000 years. And as I mentioned to you before, mm-hmm. you know, in the Jewish Bible, we have a book called the Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther, mm-hmm. the Book of Esther, who teaches the Book of Esther. That teaches the Jew how to infiltrate into foreign administrations and to influence them to serve the Jewish tribe.
Gilad, when was this written, you're saying?
This was written in 2005. It was published by Counterpunch. And I think that you can still find it on Counterpunch or many other places. And it's called From Esther to IPAC, or From IPAC to Esther.
Gotcha. And when was this Book of Esther, the real book?
I don't know when the Book of Esther was written, and actually it doesn't matter when the Book of Esther,
but it was thousands of years ago.
It doesn't matter where that, because one of the first things that you read when you try to learn about the Book of Esther is that it doesn't really reveal any it doesn't expose any historical or follow any historical factuality.
Okay,
you see what I mean?
Yes.
Okay.
But the Jewish people have been learning for as long as the Book of Esther has been out how to infiltrate into foreign governments. So that's why you're saying AIPAC itself, although it's been around it's like 50 years, 40, 50 years.
Listen, AIPAC is just a name, you know. I think that most of your listeners, for instance, do not know about the reasons that led America to join First World War, you know, which is pretty fascinating. I assume that you know about the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah, sure. It's just—it's not even one page. It doesn't even fill a whole page.
Yeah, and the Balfour Declaration is a very interesting declaration that was given by the British government, by Lord Balfour in 1917, and it promises the Jews a national state in Palestine, while the British are not even in Palestine.
Right.
You know, which is a very strange thing to do, since when, you know, British give such promises, and it's very hard to understand. And I never understood. In Israel, when I tried to read about it, what I found out was, what they used to say was that there was a guy called Chaim Weizmann, who later became the Israeli first president, who was a very enthusiastic Zionist, a very powerful Zionist operator. He was kind of an old AIPAC guy, you know, who was operating internationally.
Right.
And he was a very important scientist for the Brits, and the Brits loved him so much, so they gave his people a land. This doesn't make sense. Brits are slightly more sophisticated than that. And this story of Balfour Declaration never made sense to me. However, only 3, 4, maybe 5 years ago, I read in a book written by an Israeli exile historian called Amos Eilon, a book that I actually highly recommend. It's called The Pity of It All.
The Pity of It All.
The Pity of It All.
Right.
About the German Jewry between Mendelssohn to World War II. However, what he wrote was astonishing. Was that the Brits realized in 1916, 1917, that they don't have a chance to win the war, First World War, unless the Americans join in. And they tried to pressure the Americans, they tried to negotiate, and at a certain stage, the British ambassador in Washington, and this letter is apparently available still, you know, in archives. I've spoken to people who read it, said, listen, there is no chance for Americans to join the war. There is a Jewish conspiracy against us in Washington and in New York. And the issue was that Jewish bankers were supportive of the Germans. Why? Because they were Germans, and German Jews were very, very patriotic. And British government couldn't decide what to do. And then they came with a very clever idea. You know, they came with Balfour Declaration. A few months later, America was in the war. You know,
it's similar to Truman's recognition of Israel to get the Jewish vote in 1948.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So you see, you don't really need AIPAC. AIPAC is just a name. It's just a name, a symbolic name for a tribal operation that is practiced all along the history of humanity.
Right. So you have written extensively about this, and as I mentioned earlier, even the Prime Minister of Turkey has taken what you've said. You write very forcefully, very clearly. Your website is your first name, Gilad, that's GILAD.co.uk. Anybody could go on that that site and see what we're talking about here. You can see the About tab, music, Gilad's music, his writings and his thoughts live. I don't know what live is, Gilad, on there. The gallery, the media, and contact. But the stories are under the latest on the site tab here, and you can see exactly what Gilad is saying. And as I said earlier, Gilad was born in you were raised in Jerusalem, but you were born in Tel Aviv. Is that right?
I was born not too far from Tel Aviv. Yeah.
Okay, you were born not too far from Tel Aviv, and
you
were raised in Jerusalem, which of course is claimed by all three major religions. We were talking a little bit about how the site, Jerusalem, has been in the Jewish history, at least according to this book I was going over. The Muslims really don't, they can't claim Jerusalem because there's nothing in the Quran that says anything about Jerusalem. The Christians want to claim Jerusalem because of their top figure there, Jesus. But then you told me that that what I was saying was part of the Jewish propaganda, Zionist propaganda, that really Jewish were not in Jerusalem.
Yeah, no, this is obviously there is some evidence of Jews in Jerusalem, 2 millenniums ago, but. The Jews that we know today have obviously nothing to do with those Jews. And, as I mentioned before, if it's legitimate to come back to a land after 2,000 years,
right.
we can also predict that in the next few years, we may meet many Italians who come to Britain.
Right.
Who claim the entire country?
Right, Piccadilly Circus.
Piccadilly Circus, definitely.
Right.
You know, and I live not far from Kilburn High Road. You know, this is a road that goes from Park Lane to Glasgow. You know,
look out for the Romans. Here come the Italians.
Yeah, here come the Italians, the Romans. You right. know, so this argument is ridiculous. Now, if Italian would come with such an argument, you know. You will either arrest them or shoot them.
Right.
But when a Jew comes with such an argument, for some reason, you take it seriously, which is fascinating.
Do the Jews control the media?
I think that there is no doubt about Jewish being heavily. Located within some central junction of media and politics, within the capitals of the Western world. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt about it. By the way, this is not a conspiracy.
Right.
It's all exposed. It's all in the open. It's mainstream news.
Conspiracy has to be hidden.
I believe so.
Right, they're not hiding anything. They openly control the media, but you can't say that.
This is I think a very interesting way. There is a very interesting method that you are hinting at. I think that instead of restricting our freedom of speech. By legislation,
right.
Laws or whatever, in the Western world, and especially in the English-speaking world, our freedom is restricted by some devastating ideologies such as political correctness. What is political correctness? Political correctness is an ideology that shatters your freedom of speech and doesn't even allow you to protest.
Right.
Which is very, very...
Dangerous.
It's very, very dangerous.
Right. And go ahead.
No. And obviously, I think that there is a lot of good things about political correctness. But as long as it kind of preach for tolerance. But what we see at the moment as especially when it comes to Jewish power, is that Israel, you know, is exploiting this political correctness. But as we can see, you know, they never know when to stop. They never know when to stop. And now, their barbarism is exposed, and we allow ourselves to say it's not just Gilad Atzmon who say what they're doing. It's actually Lord Goldstone.
Right, and of course the U.S. Congress came out with their H.R. 876 to make sure Goldstone's report was not taken with any seriousness.
I think that all those measures, when, you know, the Goldstone report is a very interesting report, because in spite of all the measures that were taken against it due to pressures of Jewish groups, you know, in spite of all of that, this report is taken very seriously, and as a matter of fact, it is even taken seriously by the Israelis. But this is just one drop in the ocean. There we have so much more than that. At the end of the day, we all witnessed white phosphorus bursting over schools and United Nations shelters.
Yes,
in Gaza. So we don't really need Goldstone. Don't really need Goldstone.
Right.
You know, Goldstone just reassured what we already saw and were devastated by.
Right, sure, absolutely. But Israel's puppets on Capitol Hill make sure that the white phosphorus can continue to explode on innocent civilians, unfortunately, it seems.
I think that you're probably right, but I thought about it today. You know, I walked 2 weeks ago with a great Romanian singer, and she told me about the Romanian Revolution, about Ceausescu.
Mm-hmm.
She was a kid, you know, she was 14 years old. She saw it in the television, and Ceausescu was talking in a kind of a mass rally, and some people started to shout, and she remembered her mother, oh my God, why are they shouting? And then suddenly more and more people started to shout, and Ceausescu was evacuated, and 2 days later he was dead. When at a certain stage, I think that what we're seeing now with Israel is very similar. The anger against this barbarism is really deeper than any than what we may think it is. I can see it for me it's like a fire in a dry field in the summer. I can see it all over. I see it when I open my mouth in my concerts. Right. You know. I always open my mouth in my concerts.
Yeah.
I see the support for Palestine and the resentment towards these Zionist groups is really overwhelming.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners are sure hoping that what you're saying is correct, and I want to thank you so much, Gilad, for taking the time out of a precious night over there, because as you told me earlier, you had a canceled gig, so you're able to fit me in. I really appreciate it, and I hope that that we can speak with you again.
Whenever you know, if you give me enough notice. You know, today we were very lucky, but usually I can always find time to bash the bad people.
You're the best. I appreciate your time, Gilad.
Shukran a million. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Good night. Bye-bye.